March is National Social Workers Month, which has us asking, do you know what social workers really do?
Social work is like a chaos coordinator position.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a trio of social workers about their training, their careers, and the day-to-day life of a social worker. We'll also spend an academic minute looking for social justice in the marketplace. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Did you know that March is Social Workers Month? Do you know what a social worker does? Well, not many people do, and a lot of people who think they do get it wrong. So to find out how these professionals do their jobs and what exactly those jobs are, we fired up the Zoom machine and had a conversation with three licensed clinical social workers from the Lakeview Center in Pensacola, Florida. Sandra Crawford is a certified e-therapist and a master's-level certified addiction professional. Amanda Helm is clinical manager of the Lodges Residential Services at Lakeview. And Shannon Massengale is director of care coordination for the Lakeview Center, which coordinates all medical and mental health services for children in foster care in Northwest Florida's four-county area. I started the conversation with that very basic question. When you tell somebody you're a social worker, do most people have any idea what you do? And how do you answer the question when they inevitably ask?
I think most of the time they are confused by that. I think that most folks associate social work with just child welfare. That is something that I think we have to do a lot more education about. Most of our social workers at Lakeview Center actually work outside of child welfare. We work in all kinds of areas. Social work is such a broad career. A lot of social work is medical. Social work is in addiction. It's in mental health. It is in child welfare. It's in all of those places trying to help people connect with the services they need to be successful with life. That's kind of how I try to describe it.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree, too, that it seems like most people assume social work is like child welfare stuff and dealing with kids in the homes. So it's always interesting to explain the differences of, you know, it's not all children. Like you said, there's so many different aspects. And I think, I don't know a social worker that doesn't like coordinate chaos. So it's always like, social work is like a chaos coordinator kind of position, you know, but mostly it's just helping people wherever they are. And that's a big part of what social work is just meeting someone where they are and figuring out what their next step is.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with both Amanda and Sandra. I do work in the child welfare component of social work. So often I start by saying I don't remove people's children because there is a big range of what social workers do. I do a lot of education and advocacy and help people understand mental health diagnoses and different levels of treatment. So there is such a wide range. And I've always seen social workers, we fill in all the gaps. So we're the sand in between the different service areas.
How far into your either career or training do you choose a specialty?
That's a hard question. I think it will vary. For me, I did not start out as a social worker. I started out as a science major, and then I changed to psychology and had my first degree, my bachelor's is in psychology. I actually have a master's in criminology and criminal justice. And then I decided to get another master's in social work because it was the degree I needed to do the job I wanted to do. So I decided fairly late in my career that it would be social work. I had already actually worked at Lakeview Center for 5 years prior to starting my social work degree.
I guess once you decide, okay, I'm going to be a social worker, when do you decide what type of social work do I want to do?
I think that the nice thing about social work is you don't have to make that decision. Because I have worked in criminal justice environments, I've worked with child welfare, I've worked with mental health, substance abuse. Not to say I have a short attention span, but when the time comes that I feel like I've maxed out in that venue, I still have multiple other options to use my educational background and help people in a different way.
Absolutely. It is one of the major pros of being a social worker is that you can work in a variety of areas. You can work in the medical field, you can work in the mental health or behavioral health field, you can work in, you know, with military populations. It's a huge reaching career path for sure. But I think one thing that really does a good job of helping people find the right fit is the internship part of our social work education. Most programs, you will have to do multiple different internship placements. And so I know folks have encouraged me, and I encourage folks to choose a variety of different avenues, different parts of social work to see which one is your best fit. And even those placements that aren't the right fit give you so much benefit in networking and in education. I did an internship that was in the medical field, and I did not choose that as my career path thus far. However, it has benefited me hugely in helping the population that I work with now.
I agree. I mean, the ones that I didn't go down that route were just as important. I came into the field 18 years ago, and at that time, I did not want to work with children. That was not my interest whatsoever. And then I have found myself in the last 8 years primarily working with children and their families, and it is the right place for me right now.
Yeah, that's really what it is. I knew I wanted to work with mental health when I did my internship. Doing those internships can help you explore different environments and everything. I did my internship at West Florida Community Care Center, and that was when I figured out, you know, I love mental health and I want to do this. And then I did an internship with Nadi Works, was working with like child welfare stuff. And I knew I enjoyed that, but what just wasn't like the passion. But I agree with both of them that social workers wear many different hats and can go in many different fields and be flexible and do many different things.
What gives you job satisfaction? What is a success for you?
For me, it is seeing someone thriving in their life because I've been at Lakeview for 15 years of my career. And I have had the privilege of seeing people at their very worst moments of their life now come back and be successful in the community. I've bumped into people at the mall or Walmart who have their custody of their children, who are doing successful, who have thrived and, you know, been engaged in their substance abuse treatment and mental health treatment, and really just get to give back and be a member of the community based off of the help they've received. And every single time, that is just eye-opening and a blessing and reminds me of why I show up on Monday morning.
100%. It's watching that success and it's watching progress. It's watching people change for the better and watching them implement the things that we work with them on and reaping the benefits of those changes and new coping skills and new things. So it can be anything from seeing somebody who, you know, physically just looks healthier than they did on day one, and seeing people who come back after years and they tell you about their new job and show you pictures of their new significant other and their wedding and their kids. It is all about helping people change their lives for the better.
Yeah, a lot of times that joy comes when they have grasped that hope for themselves. You know, a lot of times I think social workers are holding on to that hope, going like, I know you can do it. And then they realize for themselves, oh, I can do it. And they grasp that hope themselves and are able to thrive and make lives for themselves when before they were just taking it one day at a time. And now they're taking it one day at a time with a lot of good life-giving things for them. So it's really seeing that change in them that they didn't think they could get, and they have it now.
You may not be able to answer this question, and that's fine if you can't, but I'm going to shoot it out there anyway. Of course, using no names, is there a single success story that just stands out to you?
I have a problem where there are too many.
I was going to say the same thing.
And the fun thing about this is that you redefine, for me, is that over the, you know, I'm with Shannon, I've been with Lakeview for, this is my 16th year. And over that time period, I have redefined what success means. And success doesn't necessarily mean that they finish a program successfully, or they don't relapse on substances, or that they don't still have challenges. Success is just a, you know, they're doing much better in life. So, you know, I've had people come back and tell me about jobs that they never thought they would have gotten. And there are people who end up going into this field themselves to help other people. And what a huge success story is that. And some folks who have been successful and are helping other people now to be successful in terms of being, you know, within the addiction community, they're sponsoring folks, they're helping connect people to treatment, they're helping them to be successful. So I think that those are some of the highlights in my world.
Yeah, luckily I've had the opportunity to witness a lot of success. And I think the same thing over the time I've had to redefine what success looks like, that happily ever after isn't really a realistic expectations for most people, myself included. And so just having that hope and faith and seeing that things are better than they were a week ago or 6 months ago is so important to that. And because of I've stuck around long enough, I've seen kids that I worked with who were first graders, second graders, go on to graduate high school and been able to see them, you know, be an important member of our community.
Where are the disappointments then? What can be frustrating about this whole thing?
A lot. I always tell people when I talk about my job that the biggest benefit of my job is being able to make connections with people and watch them be successful. The biggest drawback is building connections with people and having to watch them stumble. And it is a field that requires really good boundaries, making sure that we're doing what we can to help other people, but making sure that we're not taking ownership of their choices and their decisions. That's something that I know is really difficult for a lot of folks that work in this field, just in the helping fields, you know, feeling like you're powerless some days to help folks. But it is that piece of, again, redefining success. And even if somebody stumbles or even if somebody chooses to take a different path or doesn't, you know, do what you would want for them to do, there's always that hope that you have planted a seed that will lead to making better choices and success in the future.
And I think, I mean, for me, rarely do I get frustrated with the people. Often I get frustrated with the systems we have to work within. Because as much as there is opportunity for being innovative and thinking outside the box, there's still rules and laws and regulations that we have to comply with, both with our license in the state of Florida, criminal justice system and Medicaid. And, you know, there's many systems that can move slowly towards change. And so sometimes my frustration is with the systems and not necessarily the people we're serving.
I would definitely agree with that. I think there's still a lot of stigma too, as well with our people. And so when you're advocating for different resources, a lot of times, you know, different agencies or programs will see like schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia, and not want to work as hard for them, not want to provide the housing or the job, you know, and you've got just a lot of barriers when you're working with mental health. And I think that's the biggest frustration or disappointment is, you know, when you have people who are working so hard and they have made it to where they need to go and the next step is just right there, but the stigma, you know, stops the community or stops whatever next step that they have.
Sandra, I love the term you use there with boundaries, setting up those boundaries. That has to really take a lot out of you, doesn't it?
It does. I think it's one of the things that is the most important for folks to learn if they're going to work in this field is having those good boundaries, maintaining positive, well-structured, helping relationships. Because for many of the folks that we serve, they don't have a long history of really, truly healthy relationships. And so that relationship with their therapist, with their social worker becomes one of the first really, truly relationships that can teach them some of those healthy boundaries, which then benefit them in their own success moving forward. But it is a hard lesson for most of us to learn. It takes experience and it takes some education. I think it's one of the really good things about the internship piece of this field, getting out there and working with people and learning about setting boundaries, having, you know, a internship supervisor to help you through those. And then, you know, we require, in order to be licensed, we require 2 years of supervised practice. And so working with someone else to help navigate some of those things. But it is really difficult because you want to help people, but you have to help people in the right ways. And that's a hard lesson for a lot of people.
And Shannon, I imagine setting up boundaries with kids.
Yeah, it certainly can be challenging, especially because kids that I work with have complex trauma. And so typically they're not coming from home environments where anyone has ever established boundaries. So they're having to learn it from myself and the other adults in their lives. And then we're teaching their parents at the same time, so that they can be successful as a family.
Still to come, our social worker roundtable conversation continues with this inevitable question. How has COVID changed the way social workers do their job? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. And today we are using Social Workers Month as a very convenient excuse to talk to some social workers and find out how they do their jobs and what those jobs exactly are. Sandra Crawford is a certified e-therapist and a master's level certified addiction professional. Amanda Helm is clinical manager of the Lodges Residential Services at the Lakeview Center in Pensacola, Florida. And Shannon Massengale is director of care coordination for the Lakeview Center, who coordinates all medical and mental health services for children in foster care in Northwest Florida's four-county area. The next question, well, it had to come. How has COVID-19 changed the way you do your jobs?
COVID has created a lot of struggles. I'm not going to lie about that. It has been a challenge to maintain program delivery. I think that Lakeview Center and I think that our field as a whole has done a really great job. And I think in some ways it's propelled us forward towards providing services via telehealth, which is something that's been coming for a long time. And this has been a really big strong push in that direction, which lines up with social work, meeting people where they are, overcoming boundaries. A lot of folks don't have easy, reliable transportation. So being able to do services in their home is remarkable. The challenges are very evident in our residential settings because how do we keep everybody safe and still provide services? In my world, you know, we work with addiction and addiction is still killing people every day. It is a deadly disease that is progressive, and the stress of COVID has created more difficulties for the folks that we're serving. And so we need, you know, to be able to provide just as many services, if not more than what we did previously. But that's been a really difficult thing to do and maintaining the safety of staff and those people that we serve. So I think we've learned a lot, and I think it has been a great opportunity for ourselves, for our communities, and for society in whole to take a step back and focus on the greater good instead of being so selfish and putting ourselves first.
Yeah, I was going to say a similar thing. You know, it has offered us some great opportunities. In my world, kids in foster care don't always have stable placement, which means they can move anywhere in the state. And so the downside of that was if they leave our general area, that meant they had to start with a new therapist and a new doctor and all of that. But with the opportunity to have telehealth, that's limited that. But if they had a connection with an adult, that they could continue to work with that person regardless of where they were placed in the state. So that's been wonderful to foster some of those connections. But of course, it certainly has come with additional challenges. That high level of stress that everyone has faced has led to some increase of significant abuse and neglect because there weren't people in those homes seeing those kids. And then for my team, it really drove home the importance of self-care. I have several staff members who have lost family members due to COVID, and trying to balance out helping others and taking time to heal ourselves has really been a focus for us to make sure that you can't give of yourself if you have nothing left. You know, that we really have to take an opportunity to step back and make sure we're taking care of ourselves so that we can be as healthy as possible to help our clients learn how to be healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this year, because I mean, it was just this time last year we're starting everything, has caused all the problems that both Sandra and Shannon mentioned. But I think it has taught us how to be more intentional about mental health and asking people how they are and where they are and really being intentional about the connections we make with the people we serve, as well as the people we work with and who work under us, who work over us, being more intentional about knowing if they're safe. Is your family safe? How is everybody doing? You know, before, I think we were just kind of maybe going through the motions. So this has kind of been a kick there to be more intentional with those connections with all of the people we serve and our staff.
So where do the social workers go when they need a little help?
Each other, for sure.
That social component, at least for me, has been the hardest thing this year because social work, you know, we interact. And so interacting in this platform is very different. You know, I'm used to being able to go up a hallway and, you know, ask for assistance with something, having to be a little bit more transparent when I have a need, because they might not see that I'm having a hard day unless I tell someone. So it's some personal responsibility to know where your limits are and those boundaries and when you need to ask for help.
So what advice would you have for students or anyone else thinking about entering this field?
Caffeinate.
Mine is you have to have really good boundaries. You have to be good at being able to balance your own self-care, your own priorities, your own life, and then work. And that's tough. Most people get into this field because they have a big heart and they want to help, and learning ways to do that that create healthy relationships for people. That's my biggest advice. And to find folks that they can learn from. Find a good supervisor, find a good person that is a go-to to ask those questions, to bounce things off of, and to explore their options in this field before they just pick one because they think that that sounds like fun. Because other ones are just as important. And, you know, I don't know about these other two ladies, but I know where I ended up, I would not have thought would be where I am had you asked me when I first started school. Even when I first got into psychology, I would not have chosen working in addiction. And I've done it for almost 16 years and I love it. And at this point, I don't picture myself doing anything different.
Yeah, I would say prepare to be a lifelong learner, because in social work, if there comes a moment that you think you know it all, then you might be burnt out and need to take a break to regroup, because things are ever growing and changing as we learn more about brain development and addiction and mental health and, you know, resources in our community. Things are ever growing and changing. So, you know, it's important to make sure that they are, have the personality to keep their finger on the pulse of those changes. And then I agree with what Sandy was saying about having those boundaries and learning to balance personal and professional life, recognizing that that will be impacted by their professional choices. I became a mom 2 years ago and I thought that I had things under control before that, and I was very wrong. And so learning to balance that and figure out those intricacies, and also having some compassion and grace for the people we work with, because most days I am a pretty functional adult and I fall and fail constantly. So of course, you know, the people we work with should be offered that same understanding.
Yeah, I would say find your people, whoever those are that's going to hold you accountable and also comfort you. Find your people, find what grounds you, you know, what things keep you who you are and remind you who you are. And then go into almost every situation believing that everyone's doing the best they can with what they have. And that's for yourself as well. And if you go into those situations, you're going to come out differently than you would have if you didn't have that mindset.
Have a sense of humor, because we see people often on the worst day of their life. Kind of like I said before, you know, giving them grace in that, because no one looks for services. You know, we are the last in the line usually of what people are out there looking for to be successful. So often you're seeing them at their very worst, and we want to help them to be their very best, but that takes more than just one person's effort.
Yeah, I also think it's important to remember that it doesn't matter what brings people in for help. It matters what they do once they get there, which I think is fascinating. Within the world of addiction, research has time and time again proven that it doesn't matter what brings people into treatment. The success rates are the same, whether or not they're court ordered. So a lot of that judgment piece, you know, most people seeking treatment services are doing so because there's an issue in their world. There's some external motivator. I like to share with people that, you know, if I could do so and still feel healthy and still fit into my clothing, I would love to eat Krispy Kreme donuts every day. I don't do that because of the consequences that choice has. And so that's, you know, that's true for most folks seeking assistance, whether it be anything, you know, mental health and addiction and those struggles are no different than physical health. Yeah.
Sandra Crawford is a certified e-therapist and a master's level certified addiction professional. Amanda Helm is a clinical manager of the Lodge's residential services at the Lakeview Center. And Shannon Massengale is director of care coordination for the Lakeview Center, who coordinates all medical and mental health services for children and foster care in Northwest Florida's four-county area. All three women are licensed clinical social workers. And thanks to the Lakeview Center for helping us put together and schedule this conversation. Let's take a break from social work and look for a little social justice. That is the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Free markets cannot be counted on to erase social injustices. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Nancy Niemann, professor of political science, explains why.
A series of market crises over the past several decades, financial, environmental, health, education, poverty, have reinvigorated the debate about markets and social justice. Since then, popular movements all over the globe are attempting to redefine markets and the meaning of economic enterprise in people's daily lives. Often, assessments of market outcomes result in opposing political and economic voices facing off to argue the benefits or harms brought about by markets. Yet not enough of these conversations are focused on analyzing the conditions under which markets can result in just or unjust outcomes. My research finds markets as deeply embedded societal structures, which tend to perpetuate underlying social conditions, both just and unjust. Culture, politics, and ideology help shape market incentives. For example, when markets operate within the context of patriarchal and racist norms, such as labor relations in the U.S. meatpacking industry and the globalization process in Juarez, Mexico, markets tend to exacerbate those injustices. Free markets, or the invisible hand, cannot be counted on to erase social injustices, as many have suggested. Similarly, when markets operate in the context of strong community norms, such as the financial reform process in Cuba or an interfaith coffee cooperative in Uganda, rational market actors are incentivized to make decisions that are in the best interest of community. This is not because they are selfless or irrational, but because those decisions are in fact in the best interest of those whose identities are inseparable from their communities. When embedded in infrastructures of justice, markets tend to promote socially just outcomes. This becomes a strong argument for what I call the rationality of justice in terms of individual decision-making and the market as a whole. That is, promoting justice makes practical sense.
That was Nancy Niemann of Scripps College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.